Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. In about 15 minutes from now, we'll stroll down to Studio A for a live performance from His Golden Messenger. But first, a look at vended art.
I'm Bethany Chafin. Most art is sold from or housed in a museum, a gallery, a studio, found on the walls of a restaurant, or maybe displayed in a garden or public space. So one place you might not expect to find it is being dispensed from a refurbished cigarette vending machine. The concept is called Artomat, and with $5 and a sense of curiosity, a piece of art from an Artomat can be yours. From wearable art to woodblock landscapes, Polaroid photos, handmade miniatures, even a mini robot made from capacitors, the possibilities for the things you can find in an Artomat are endless, as long as they fit into a 3x2-inch box. The Artomat and the artists behind it aim to produce progressive art that's both personal and accessible. Winston-Salem-based Clark Whittington is the man behind the Artomat, and he stopped by WFDD to tell me more. Tell me how the concept first came to you and what year. Was it 97 from what I understand?
Well, I started Artomat in 97. The original machine was based on an observation that I had. A lot of my art at the time was conceptual and documenting encounters, experiences, things like that. And in the late 80s, when I worked at a printing company, a friend of mine, he had a Pavlovian reaction to snack wrappers. So he'd go to a vending machine when he'd hear the crinkle of someone opening something from a vending machine. So I sketched that in a sketchbook, and it sat dormant there for a while until I moved to Winston in 97. And that was the time when cigarette machines were being banned, and I got one for free and converted it into the first Artomat. After that, the owner of the coffee shop, Penny University, Cynthia Giles, she said, "We can't let you take this. We love it too much." So we started inviting artists to help keep it filled. So that's where Artomat went from a me to a we. It's more of a collaborative sort of relationship now with anywhere from 300 to 400 artists from around the world at any given time.
Were you working on that size, that scale before that, or was it kind of an adjustment where your piece is a little bit larger than that and you had to scale down?
Yes and no. I did some 2-inch by 3-inch paintings back in the late 80s when I had a gallery in Charlotte. So I'd stretch little miniature canvases. And the reason I did that is because a lot of my art was not sellable. A lot of it would end up in dumpsters after the show at times. And, you know, I just wanted to focus on the idea and the concept, and sometimes the quality just wasn't there. So I got tired of moving these canvases around and carrying them around, so I worked small with that. Maybe that led to the small work that went into the initial Artomat, but I consider the first Artomat as one of 13 pieces in that show at Penny University back in June of 97.
Could you describe the actual vending machine itself? Because if you go on your website today, you can see images of all of them that are now across the country. And the vending machines themselves are beautiful, and they all have a character, it seems. So what did that first one look like?
Well, it looks about the same. This machine is still in operation at Mary's Gourmet Diner down in the Arts District. It's pretty rough. It's humble. I find it that it's beautiful, but it's pretty raw around the edges. So that machine came from, what I can tell, it came from the original West End Cafe, the little small cafe. And I didn't have any money at all to do any cosmetic stuff. So I found scrap roofing paper and my airbrush and acrylic paint, and I just spelled out Artomat and stuck it on there. That was originally selling things for $1, $4, and then nowadays it's geared for tokens.
Could you tell me how, you know, that $5 is divvied up? Some of it is going to the host site, is that right? And
yes.
Some's going to the artist, mm-hmm. And how does that work?
When I started this, I had no idea I'd be doing it full time. I was just wanting to sell art cheap and get it into people's hands. So we've sort of adapted over the years, and we've kind of worked ourselves into a corner with the $5 price point, where most people who aren't familiar with art, they're not terribly uncomfortable spending $5 to experience something that they may not quite understand. That makes it harder for us as artists to produce at that price point. But end of day, it allows people to experience art. So that's the main goal. When it comes down to the breakdown of the money, the artists are doing most of the heavy lifting, so they get 50%, so that's $250. And the host gets $1.50 because usually they pay a fee up front to make a machine happen, and they bring it to their community. And that can be quite expensive for some venues across the country or some of our venues out of the country. It can be very expensive. So they're committing to our mission and our mindset. Our studio gets $1.
That reminds me of something I've read that you commented that the Artemat sort of is contradicting the cliches around art. And I'm wondering what you see or saw as some of those cliches and how that actually works, how it's contradicting those.
So what I found is if you do your best to explain art to people in a genuine way and not in a way that would look down on them or be condescending, they respond very well. So I think when it comes to the art world, there's a lot of stigma that is meant to be for the elite or the rich. And Artemat is very affordable, and we're reaching people who may have never bought art or never visit museums.
So how does someone become an artist that is featured in an Artemat machine?
The world is invited to participate. I want to share this with anyone who feels that it's up their alley. I feel as long as it's worth $5 and doesn't get anyone in trouble, we can find a place for people's art. So I hope that more artists would step up. Right now, we do need high quality work that really stands strong after the purchase and after the buyer's walked two or three steps away from the machine. Because that's what really makes magic happen when people realize, wow, look at that.
So this sort of all started at Penny University. That was a coffee house in Delhi, right?
It was a coffee house down off Brookstown.
Okay, neat.
Yeah.
So how did it grow and where are Artemats today?
The first few months, we started hitting up some places like had a machine at Morning Dew Coffee Shop. And then places like Green Hill Center was like our third venue. That's in Greensboro. So we now have about 120 machines around the country and some outside the country. One in Vienna, Austria, two in Australia, one in Vancouver, British Columbia, one in the UK somewhere. It's a new venue. They're going to move their machine around, temporary venue. So I don't really know where that machine is right this minute. But anyway, all of these venues just really acted like they wanted to be a part of Artemat, and that makes it a lot easier to have a working relationship.
So you have a swap meet coming up in DC. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. This is something we do periodically, usually every 5 years during an anniversary. We'll have this thing called a swap meet. We have them every once in a while on off years, and we're having one in Washington, DC this July. But a swap meet is basically kind of like an arts fair for Artemat, where artists will set up tables for the day and show people what they do and meet each other, show off some of the larger work, and then they'll swap Artemat pieces with each other and walk home with a collection. We did something like the third year called a convention. What we noticed was, Artemat artists were really excited to meet each other, because they realize they have something in common. But then B, they would trade Artemat art. And so we noticed this, they were having this collection. So it's kind of cool that no money was changing hands. They were just swapping little pieces of art. So I just decided to call it a swap meet. So we've had one on the 5th anniversary, the 10th. The 15th was at the Lucy Center at the Smithsonian American Art Museum a few years back. And we're having this one there again because they liked it so much, and they said some of their patrons asked when we're going to have another one. So this one is not going to be nationally per se. It's more of a regional for DC area artists, but we're also artists from the East Coast are coming to it as well.
Great. And who are some of those artists who are going to be there?
Locally, we have a few speakers, and I'm excited for this because we've never had that before. We usually would just have a band and things like that. But this time we're going to slow it down a little bit and have a few people really talk about things that maybe is hard to understand online or things like that. So one person that's going up is from Winston-Salem is Mona Wu, and she's going to discuss how she's a member of Artworks as well as an active Artimat artist, and she's going to kind of convey how the Artworks co-op has kind of embraced Artimat to make work as a group and how that benefits the exposure of the gallery locally as well as nationally. So I'm excited about that because Artworks is the only co-op adult artists who have pulled together to make Artimat art for us. We've had classes. In many cases, the teachers had to assign the students to pull together and work as a collective. But in regard to adult artists, it's unique that they actually get along and can work together for a common goal, something like this. So that's really nice. Then we have a few other artists. One artist from Virginia, Lisa Marie Adams, she's going to discuss how she had a mental block for a year before she got the courage to submit her prototype to Artimat. So I think that's going to be interesting to hear because I think we all go through that. I think sometimes artists, we overthink it. A few other artists who will be coming up from North Carolina is Jennifer O'Kelly and Brian Cunningham.
Artimat inventor Clark Whittington. And as Clark says, the world is invited to participate. And this weekend, artists and interested parties will be meeting at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Swap Meet at the Luce Foundation Center at the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C. For more information on Artimat, to see pictures of Artimat machines around the country, and to find one near you, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Bethany Chafin.
This is Triad Arts Weekend, and up next we go behind the scenes with Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton.
If anybody doubted it before, I think we all know now that Netflix has really arrived. Not only are they getting big numbers for Orange is the New Black and House of Cards, their original series, but they have the credibility that Emmy nominations can bring. Orange is the New Black is nominated as comedy series, and I'm not sure I always think it's a comedy, but that's okay. That's their category. And in directing, writing, and various performances. House of Cards is nominated as best drama series, also in directing, writing, and various performances. The shows are easy to access if you haven't seen them because they're both streaming on Netflix. You can watch them anytime you want for the monthly subscription fee. I've been thinking a lot about why season 2 of both shows is just a little bit less satisfying for me than season 1. Orange is the New Black is set in a women's prison, and House of Cards is set in Washington, D.C. in a political landscape that appears to me is populated by even bigger criminals. One series humanizes the characters a little bit too much, and the other dehumanizes too much. Both of them leave me feeling that a little bit of dramatic middle ground would be an improvement. Two online posts started me on this path of thinking. Allison Samuels wrote in the Daily Beast that she won't watch Orange is the New Black because, quote, "I'm simply not entertained by shows that feature large numbers of black people exiting, entering, or already in prison." Context is everything. And sometimes, maybe it's a little too much. Allison Rosenberg asked the question in her Washington Post blog whether Orange is the New Black has to humanize everyone. That really struck a nerve with me. Once the character Red, for example, was feared, now her backstory is softer and sucks us in. You know, there's so much that this show does right. And learning the backstories of the characters is essential to establishing the larger cultural context that makes me see the series differently from Allison Samuels. I want to watch it. But still, there are times when I think the balance was tipped this season. Not so with House of Cards. I prefer the structure and aesthetics of Orange is the New Black to this series, but that's not my biggest problem with it. House of Cards dehumanizes everyone. and everything in the service of promoting Frank and Claire Underwood's hideous agenda to accumulate as much power as possible. It's a dark, dark view with no truth and no possibility that I've seen so far of redemption. I just don't think unadulterated cynicism is a direction that serves us well as a culture. Maybe this is why I can binge watch Orange is the New Black, but House of Cards, I have to take a break between episodes.
Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. We have to take one more 60-second break, but when we return, the music of MC Taylor, a.k.a. His Golden Messenger, live in Studio A. Stick around.